right. Welcome, everyone, to the Sean Steele Law Firm podcast. Today, we are joined by somebody who holds or held a position that to many of us is mysterious, if not nefarious. We have tried many times to get somebody from the defense side, an attorney or an adjuster on the podcast. Once actually getting an attorney on and then having to then take that podcast down after it went live because we got them in a lot of trouble. And so we're very excited to welcome Kieran Doherty. He is currently of the Simon Law Group, a plaintiff's law firm that I have a lot of respect for and I've done some work with. Formerly of Farmers Insurance, did adjusting there and supervising there for a decade, and then did a year on the defense side, on the dark side, before switching to the light and joining the ranks of some of the best trial attorneys that I know over at Simon Law Group. Kieran, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Good afternoon, everyone.
So start us off with a little bit of history. I mean, what got you into being an adjuster? And then, I mean, we only have a half an hour. So jump right in after that to sort of what, I mean, what is that like? What is that like?
Yeah, so funny, my mom was an administrative assistant with the Farmers Insurance Property Department. I was out of college. I was working at a physical therapy office, actually. Worked at the physical therapy office for a couple of years. And I was looking for, you know, a more career-oriented job. And she's like, hey, they're hiring adjusters. I'm like, all right. So I interviewed, got the job. And, you know, coming from a physical therapy office kind of helped out. I was working with car accidents and, you know, injuries. And I kind of had a background in understanding what was going on. So I was an adjuster. And then one day I just kind of was over the corporate thing. And I just said, I'm going to sign up for the LSAT. Signed up for the LSAT. Went to school at night. Became an attorney. And it's kind of been run from there. Just ended up over here.
That's spectacular. So when you became an adjuster, so you're doing auto cases, right?
Yeah, auto and then homeowners, slip and fall stuff, but the majority of stuff dog bites, but majority auto cases.
All right. So we got a bunch of chiropractors on the call today, and there's going to be plenty more listening once this goes live. Let's jump into what were you looking for when it came to chiropractic records? Let's start with even before that. Was there any sort of prejudice? I mean, was there any sort of if a prospective plaintiff had a or claimant had a chiropractor or saw or treated by a chiropractor, did that change anything, just that piece of information alone?
I don't think so necessarily, only because the majority of cases with auto collisions, you are seeing a chiropractor involvement, right? That's kind of the first line of treatment that you would see. You know, pain, I have, you know, injuries, my neck, my back hurts. That's typically one of the first lines of treatment. So not necessarily, I would say as a whole that adjusters are skeptical of everything. It's kind of drilled into you by the insurance companies. But I don't think chiropractor involvement just by itself was any kind of indicator of anything nefarious or kind of highlighted or anything like that.
Well, that's great news, because I know that there are definitely chiropractors listening right now, and myself included a little bit, who get the sense sometimes that just simply the fact that a chiropractor was on a case can be a strike against it. So I'm glad to hear that that wasn't the case, at least for you.
I think, to be honest with you, adjusters are going to question no matter what kind of provider is involved, no matter who is involved. You know, I'm sure, you know, orthopedic doctors are saying the same thing. So it's really just a question of everything. So
great. And okay, so good. So that's a good jumping off point. So from there, now you get a set of chiropractors records in. What are you looking for? What do you keep an eye out for? What are the red flags? Talk me through that.
Yeah, I guess I think a good way, let me kind of explain the process, what happens, right? When you get in, so for example, on the plaintiff side, we'll send in the records along with whatever records we have and the bills, right? And on the carrier side, there's actually a large software company that's kind of been buying up all the smaller claims provider softwares. And a lot of the carriers are using them now. I know people on this call maybe have heard of Colossus, which is like a dinosaur. It doesn't exist anymore, right? It's old. They learned their lesson. But this is a program similar in idea, at least, as Colossus. So medical bills and records come in. and they're sent out to be transcribed. Okay. It goes to this program and someone on that side transcribes them. From there, there's a couple different programs at play. They're all integrated together. So the first one, it looks at the bills, and it's going to sound a little crazy, but it takes automatic adjustments on them. And there's certain things that are automatic adjustments. For example, if there's hot packs billed after 4 weeks, then it depends. Each carrier is slightly different on what their automatic adjustments are, but hot packs after 4 weeks, they're cutting them, right? Some things doesn't take an automatic adjustment on, it'll be a flag and it'll say, listen, you need to address this. You need to, you know, say it. And one of the examples of that is hot packs after 2 weeks, right? They'll look at it and they'll say, all right, with the flag, you can allow it, but you got to address it. Other things that might be a flag would be like, they'll look at like, oh, you treated back-to-back days. I know, I'm sure everyone's heard that. Treatment after 12 or 16 weeks, things, you know, things that you hear, the arguments they make that at the end of the day don't hold water, but they're still going to be made. And then, so once it's transcribed, those are automatic. That's, the adjuster's not touching this, the adjuster's not looking, that's just done, right? The adjuster looks at it, pull up. From there, the adjuster goes through and they look through and they say, all right, based on what I've been trained on by this carrier, I'm going to make adjustments for what they say, you know, the cost, you know, reasonable cost. And they look at it, and it's, the program will, you know, will actually take automatic adjustments on what they have as the, you know, the benchmark, what they feel like the cost should be. And the adjuster is supposed to go through and verify that that's correct and that it's not paying too much or too little. But a lot of these adjusters have way too many cases to actually be able to handle them, you know, in a way that they would like to. So they kind of just take what the program says as gospel. And then,
right.
So it makes cuts. From there, right, now that's the billing. And there's also a tool they use for generating general damages, so pain and suffering, okay?
Right.
And the interesting thing about this is the way it works is it actually takes the ICD-9 codes from the bills. All right, not the records. So if there's no ICD-9 code on the bill, or ICD-10 on the bills, apologies, it won't pull it automatically and the adjuster will have to manually put it in. But if the ICD-10 is on the bills, it pulls that automatically from the bills and brings them into this general damages program, right? So kind of on that, one of the things, you know, listen, if you have, you know, if you're listing 50 ICD-10s, the adjuster would be like, all right, all these aren't related. I'm gonna have to go through and cut some of them. But if it's appropriately listed and it applies and it's corresponds with the injuries, it makes it a little easier because it pulls them automatically and they'll give general damages based on that. It takes a lot of the thinking and the thought process. Like the adjuster's not going to forget, oh, I forgot to add that because it's already there. But it's a little weird that it takes it from the bills rather than the records.
So you're saying maybe as a tip that if you, as a chiropractor, don't put your ICD-10 codes in your bill, but just have them in the records, that it's maybe a good idea in your PI cases to start putting them in the bill, because that's where these Colossus style programs often are yanking that information for pain and suffering.
100%. And I think just making sure, you know, be thoughtful on which ones you're putting in there, make sure they apply, and
right.
You know, it makes it easier for the adjuster not to miss anything.
Sure. So they put in, I mean, you know, we sort of understand this conceptually, because we get offers, and I'm sure chiropractors have heard of this, where we'll get an offer in, you know, opening offer on the cases, we're extending $18,442.19. And you're like, yeah, a human being didn't come up with that number. A computer did, obviously, a program came up with that. That's a calculation that a computer came up with. And it sounds like what's happening is they're adjusting the bills. There's maybe some room for an adjuster to intervene in some places, but oftentimes maybe they're not even intervening anywhere. They're just taking whatever number is spit out by the bills plus the pain and suffering calculation, and that's the number they send to me.
And that's exactly correct. And yeah, those weird numbers sometimes, because they'll say, oh, the reasonable cost of this is $163.47. Like, okay, it's really specific, but all right. And then also just, so these programs, you know, everything nowadays is big data, right? You can run so many reports and there's so much data available on this. So for example, on the adjuster level, and this is kind of the things the adjusters are looking at, one of the big reports they run is bills submitted versus bills accepted, right? And so you can look at, hey, adjuster X has an average of 13,000 in bills submitted and they typically allow 11,000, but Adjuster Y has an average of 13,000 and allows 11,800. What are they doing, right? And so the adjuster is always, you know, a little concerned about, I guess, even if you build, I would say, if you build perfectly, exactly according to what the carrier trains is perfect billing, and the adjuster is still probably going to take some cuts because they are just so trained and so drilled that if the bills come in, they need to be cut. Which is kind of frustrating, right? Because even if you're doing exactly what was said to be done, you're still going to end up with some bills cut, which kind of leads to, you know.
And it creates a weird incentive to like overbill, which of course nobody wants to do, and nobody on this call I think is inclined to do, but it creates that incentive when you're going to cut, I mean, when you're sort of acknowledging that, hey, my on the adjuster side, I'm going to be cutting bills, even if they're billed textbook, just because my job, I'm graded based on how well I cut bills.
Yeah. And I think that the there might be some, on the carrier side, some objection to that language. But realistically, that's what it breaks down to, right? I mean, the thought on there is, like, well, no, we then look at it holistically and we see that, oh, maybe it was appropriate that you are allowing a little more. But realistically, with so many cases, it's really hard to, you know, go into each case individually and see, okay, maybe this adjuster is allowing a little more and it's appropriate. So it does kind of work out that if you're allowing more bills than everyone else in your office or your, you know, your region, then they're going to look into it and think, oh, why?
So in terms of allowed bills, is that just a computer designation where they just click, I'm not allowing this, or I am allowing this, or I'm allowing reducing this? Because then it seems like sometimes I'll talk to an adjuster and they'll tell me, you know, you have $11,000 in meds. I'm only accepting $6,500. And so based on that $6,500, I'm extending an offer of 10 grand. And I'm like, okay, well, my meds are 11 change, so I'm not going to take your 10 grand, obviously. But then through negotiation, whatever else, we end up at a settlement of, let's say, $20,000, which is, you know, double the meds, double my meds, not double their reduced meds. So then I wonder in those situations, well, okay, so what, why did I care, or why should anyone care what their reduced meds are, what meds they're accepting, when the settlement value sometimes doesn't seem to be based on that at all?
I mean, I would pay no attention to what they're accepting or they're planning to accept. The settlement value is the settlement value.
Right.
You know, they're going to make their arguments all day. But at the end of the day, I was, okay, that's fine.
Right.
Don't care. Don't agree with you, but sure.
Right. And as an attorney, right, and this may be less relevant for the chiropractor, but as an attorney, obviously that's how I practice. But I just have always wondered on the defense side, I am on the adjuster side, you know, okay, great, you reduced my bills by, I mean, reduce them down to zero for all I care. Like, whatever you're accepting or rejecting in your own mind, so long as it doesn't affect my settlement value.
Fully agree, 100%. And just like, so you know just how easy it is, like imagine a, you know, an Excel spreadsheet in front of you, right? This is kind of the way the program works. It looks similar. And for each visit, it has, you know, each CPT code, right, broken down. So there's four CPT codes for visit. And next to it, it has the charge, you know, the amount billed. And then next to it, it has, they use, you know, the benchmark, and it'll say benchmark 80, benchmark 50. I think they are using 80 right now. And it'll automatically put that number in. And sometimes it messes up and the adjuster is supposed to fix it. Like, oh, you know, it's allowing too little, I should increase it, which is almost never going to happen. Or it's allowing too much, I should reduce it. But for the most part, I would say, especially on, when I say like smaller cases under 75,000, the adjuster is probably just running with it, whatever it says, whatever the program says. So technically, they do have their own authority and they're supposed to review what this program is saying. But realistically, with how many cases they have, it's really just not feasible to go in depth on every single case.
And I know that. And also, there seems to be some adjusters that care quite a bit about, you know, and they'll, when I talk to them, they're telling me things about, oh, well, in this record, in this soap note, it says this. And you're like, wow, you actually seem to have read them, as opposed to some adjusters who don't seem to have any idea what's going on in the case other than the billed meds are this, I'm accepting this, and here's what I'm offering you. It's like, okay, well, call me when you know something else.
And I think that kind of leads to another good point that you're saying. There's very few adjusters that are going to go through the soap notes just because of how much time it takes, right? You know, and we have some cases, which is why if you have a concise, you know, there's a concise report that lays everything out concisely, that's specific to that patient clearly, That helps. That makes a big difference just because it's easy to get the information, right? It's just boom, it's there, it's there, it's there, it's there. It lays everything out, makes it a little easier. Rather than either, you know, trying to search through the SOAP notes and piece together the puzzle, or the report is just clearly just, you know, a template filled in where it's not for that individual patient, doesn't really give a lot of information. So that also helps just a summary, and there's something really easy for the adjuster to grab onto and be like, oh, perfect. I know what's going on right here. It's all right there. Done.
That's super helpful. So in terms of red flags, I mean, let's say it was a bigger case and you really were going to delve into the records. And I'm sure you were the adjuster exception that did that. In terms of chiropractic records, I mean, what are the red flags? I mean, what are the types of, other than obviously, you know, like you were saying, red, you know, ice, hot packs after 4 weeks or something like that. But like, what are the things that you're looking for? Not a program spotted, but like you spotted that made you say, I think we need to ask this, you know, get depose this chiropractor. I think we need to take a harder look at this chiropractor's billing or their records. And what are the red flags that you're seeing?
I don't know if this is like a red flag, but like, if like I said, these reports, right? If like, this is clearly just like a generic report where this, you know, maybe this person is seeing a ton of people and just not caring about their patients. Maybe, you know, it tells me, maybe they're not as on top of their patient care. Or sometimes you see like sometimes the billing is just like $500 a visit, right? And it's like, all right, like everyone else is in a reasonable range. That's what's going on there.
So being an outlier.
Yeah. And obviously there's certain situations that might call for it, but you know, when you are out there, it sticks out and there might be a reason for it, but sometimes there's not. As far as like deposing chiropractors, and honestly, I think the reason that a lot of or defense counsel likes to do it is because typically, you know, I think a lot of chiropractors want to focus on understanding other patients and are maybe not as well versed in the litigation world and kind of the legal standards for example, a reasonable degree of medical probability, things like that. And the defense kind of comes in and bull in a china shop and tries to bully chiropractors around because they're not getting deposed as much. You know, the ortho doctors that we're using, they're getting deposed 2-3 times a week. They know, they understand, they have the legal background, not a lawyer or anything, they understand the legal, you know, require or the language and things like that. I think when a defense attorney is, I'm going to depose a chiropractor, their goal is, you know, what their goal is in general in the case to sow confusion, right? To kind of, oh, well, the pain level was 6 out of 10 here and 5 out of 10 there. Like, what happened? That's inconsistent. And it's really just trying to trick and sow confusion.
I've had instances where a plaintiff in their deposition will say something to the effect of, oh yeah, the chiropractor told me not to worry, because when the case settles, they'll work with me on the bill. You know, they'll help me out with the bill. And then immediately depo notice for a chiropractor. You know, I mean, that sort of stuff, those sort of unforced errors. We were talking beforehand about chiropractors who report that they're billing, you know, they're seeing patients on Saturdays. You know,
oh yeah, you're seeing, and the adjusters will call your office full on. They'll call your office, pretend to be a patient and be like, hey, I want to get an appointment on a Saturday. You guys open on Saturday? No. Well, I have 4 bills, you know, sometimes we'll see like, you have these billed on Saturday for a bunch of Saturdays and they just called your office and your office told them they weren't open on Saturdays. Or, hey, I want to come in, like, you know, I hurt my back, you know, just running. Like, what's it going to cost me for this type of treatment? And they'll ask them, like, what's it going to cost me to get, you know, like last time I went to the chiropractor, they, you know, they did some hot packs, they put those like tingly things on me, and then the chiropractor like pushed on me, like, how much is it going to cost me for that? And they'll tell them, and that doesn't match up with the bill that they have. And then they'll be like, well, I just called your office and it's a lot different. And
those, well, I've never had an adjuster tell me that they've done that, but it's you're describing something in quite a bit of detail that apparently is happening out there in the world, which if I were a chiropractor would be alarming, just to make sure that everything is copacetic. Now, I think this brings up a topic that a lot of chiropractors have asked me about particularly. And so I want to ask you both in your capacity as a short while as a defense attorney, but also as an adjuster, and that's cash discounts. you know, because if you call a chiropractor's office and you say how much for an adjustment and they say, $60, and then you see a PI case where they're charging, $120 for an adjustment, that may be the product of a cash discount. And so the question becomes, well, what's a reasonable cash discount? In what circumstances are they permissible? I mean, where I understand the ethics behind it, but like from the adjuster and the defense attorney standpoint, where do you guys come down on that?
I mean, the adjuster and the defense attorney are just going to harp on that and bang on it as a.
Uh-oh. Karen, do we lose you or do we lose me? Which one of us is frozen? I'm getting the sense that it's him. Is it him? Yeah. So I'm told that, so Karen is frozen. Hopefully he can, yes. Yes, Allison. Yeah, he is frozen, and now he's coming back. He's back.
Man, I lost you for a second. You got me back now? My computer froze on us. All right, I'm on my phone now, so we can finish it up this way. I apologize.
That's okay. I'm glad that you were able to hop back in so quickly. So what were you saying?
So I was saying that, the defense and the adjuster are going to harp on it, and they're going to say, listen, they're only in it for money. They're charging their cash patients this. If they get insurance, it's this, and they're charging this. They're in it. They're over-treating. They're, at the end of the day, we know it's not true. We understand the realities. If I had my choice as the plaintiff attorney, if the cash price was the same as the lien price, that's the easiest way. But at the end of the day, it's not going to kill a case, right? It's not going to make a huge deal. In litigation, juries understand. I'm not too concerned about it. Like I said, perfect world, it's the same price, but...
I feel like the law and certainly the ethics requirements for chiropractors allow for a cash discount, which makes sense to me from a business standpoint, because the chiropractor is being forced to stick their neck out on a lien, defer billing by years sometimes, and then, let's face it, in a lot of instances, get cut to hell by a greedy PI attorney. So, because of all of that, I believe that it is settled that some amount of cash discount is permissible. The question is, at what point does it cross over? And I'm sure there's no real answer. It's not like, 1.5 times the cash, it's not like that. But I'm guessing if you were to call them and ask what the cash price was and they said $50 a visit, and then you're looking at billing for over $200 a visit, you're like, that's not a reasonable cash discount. So maybe it has to pass the smell test in terms of, yeah, all right, so maybe, you bill $75 a visit cash and it's $100 a visit on lien. It's like, well, it's only $25 extra that you're charging. It's not the end of the world. Like maybe a smell test sort of thing is what it sounds like.
Yeah, I think that's a completely fair way of putting it. Honestly, I think you described it pretty well. And like I said, here's the thing: like a lot of these arguments, adjusters and defense counsels are making, they know they're not good arguments, right? They know they're not good, but they're trying to force us as plaintiff attorneys to take lesser settlements than the case is worth. And I think, like I said, I think a reasonable cash discount, they're not going to be able to harp on that, right? I think it's like where you said, we're like, hey, if I come in cash, it's $40, and if I now I have a lien and it's $280. That they're going to be able to, the jury more so, like they're going to know, like, hey, if this goes to trial, we can use that to create a doubt in the jury's mind. So
we're down to the last 5 minutes, and I want to see if you have any tips on things they could do that they do well that helps a PI case. So maybe any anecdotal stories or. Just tips that a conscientious chiropractor, right, one that's doing PI and doing their best, trying to aid their patient both to get better and heal, but also to make sure that they are documenting their injuries in the way that is likely to yield the greatest return. What would you recommend? I mean, what kinds of tips or tricks or just advice would you give?
Well, I think there's kind of two separate parts to this. So the first part is on the litigation aspect part. And I'll start here. We had a case and defense counsel was actually they're like, we're going to depose, you know, it was actually a PT, but similar PT car. And they're like, we're going to depose them. They're, you know, they're going to try and create this, this confusion and try, you know, they're, no, they don't know. They don't understand. They're not deposed off. And we didn't even list them for us. And our expert team does not, non-retain. We didn't list them, but they did. And they deposed them via video. And this person clearly knew what they were doing and they just killed it. They knocked it out of the park. Right. And defense tried to get their testimony excluded because how good it was. So if you understand kind of what the defense is trying to do in these depositions, right, and you understand that they're trying to confuse you and you can just tell the truth and explain, you know, how you treated your patient, keep it consistent, that's huge for us, right, knowing we have them in the background. But that being said, most of the cases don't go to litigation. They don't make it that far. So I think a concise and just clear report that just lays everything out, it doesn't have to be long, right? I see like a 15-page report. I'm not going to, you know, the adjuster's not going to have time to read all that, but a nice, clear, concise, just lays out the issues. And then I think, like I said, just that little tip about putting the ICD-10s on your billing just so it's easier for the software to pick it up and bring it over to the general damages section. Obviously, that doesn't affect the bills that they're accepting, but it affects the settlement, which kind of makes it easier for everyone to get paid at the end of the day.
I mean, so we, and that's great. I mean, we commonly tell chiropractors about smart referrals, right? Alerting both the attorney and the patient to the potential assistance of referral docs. You know, oftentimes the chiropractor is the one that highlights for us, hey, you know, that I think there's a psych component to this that maybe is latent, but I'm seeing it when they're coming in. They're talking to me a lot about how they haven't driven since the accident. Oh, I didn't know that. They didn't mention that to me. Or, you know, there are many, many times that chiropractors have called me and tipped me off to either, hey, I think I want, you know, I would like to refer this patient out to this kind of subspecialty, or, you know, here's something I'm noticing or I have noticed in my interactions with the patient, or they mentioned this to me about, you know, their treatment. Hey, they said, oh, hey, I'm seeing a whatever kind of doctor, but I haven't told my attorney about it yet. I mean, like, I've heard all kinds of that stuff from chiropractors. So making smart referrals and also just having that communication level with the attorney and working with attorneys that will take your phone call. But I mean, that sort of stuff, at least from my perspective on the plaintiff side, is crucially important to aiding in the increasing of value, which obviously increases the likelihood that a chiropractor is going to get their bill paid in the end.
Yeah, and I think just making sure that your client, you know, the patient gets the right treatment, the right care. Realistically, out of all the people who are going to be involved in the treatment, you know, that chiropractors are the front line. They're the ones who are seeing them multiple times per week for a long period of time. And, you know, I worked in a physical therapy office for a couple of years, and there's a lot of talk going back and forth. And it's not always about your injuries, your treatment, but you learn a lot about people. And, you know, even more than the attorneys, they're not going to talk to them as much. So you learn a lot about them. You can learn a lot about their injuries. You can make sure they get the treatment they need and require. That helps out, obviously, the value of the case. But more importantly, it helps out the person you're treating. So I think that's huge.
I totally agree. Any parting thoughts for this group of chiropractors? I want to thank you for agreeing to do this and for coming on and sharing some inside secrets from the other side with us. You know, I think this group of chiropractors, and particularly more and more in California, we're seeing chiropractors wanting to learn how the whole picture works, right? Not just their little piece to the puzzle, but that's what the whole, you know, ethos of this podcast is how does my piece fit within the bigger scheme of PI, and how can I better practice within a PI sphere? How can I do better by my patients, by the attorneys that I work with, by, you know, by myself? Obviously they're in this to make money just like everybody else is. So I thank you for doing this, but I wonder if there's any last minute tips or parting words you have.
I mean, honestly, keep learning. I love that. I think anyone who's on or kind of continuing to learn and continuing their education, like that's awesome. And like you said, the more you know about kind of what happens down the road, you know, most cases don't go to trial or don't get to the point where even where anyone's getting deposed. But if you understand what happens when that does happen, it'll help you just in your practice kind of every day.
Perfectly summed up. I appreciate that a lot. Kieran, thank you for being with us. Thank you for sharing your wisdom with everybody. If anybody has a question that they want to send to you, would you mind if it came through me and I forwarded it?
Yeah, feel free. Send me whatever. Reach out anytime. And appreciate you having me. Apologies for the tech issue, but we sorted it out. We got multiple different things going on.
Absolutely, this is live theater, right? So it's gonna happen live. But I appreciate you so much for being on. This is Kieran Doherty with Simon Law Group, Alexander Eisner, Sean Steele Law Firm podcast. This podcast will be available on iTunes and wherever else you get your podcasts. It will also be available on YouTube shortly. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and good afternoon.
Thanks, Alexander.
Take care, man.